university. They were going to make their fortune in Petroski turnips. Yeah, remember?
From the seed. He let them go to seed.
Yeah, and they were going to make their fortune. And the advertising came out. What was it? What was that advertising?
Skyland Acres. Petroski turnips. Two bits for a package, I think, or something like that.
And something, Skyland Acres, the something surrounded by Alaska. Don't you remember?
Yeah,
it was very flowery and very lovely.
And that was from this, Borden?
Yeah. Yes, this was old Borden. Yeah. With Jack Shanley. Jack Shanley was the first graduate that came up from here. He was from Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And he wandered to here, so we had to graduate the first year of the college.
And Shanley put some little ads in the magazines in the States, and orders came piling in. And
for the turnips?
For the turnip seed.
And
they didn't have any.
He'd take a coin or two out of an envelope and stick it in his pocket and forget all about it. So my brother said, I don't know.
Yeah, that was the Borden, and that was where he was, that's right.
Well, today at lunch, it was so typical, you know, we started talking about elk, you know, just, I mean, it wasn't the subject of conversation, but just the names that came up. I bet if everyone who attended that thing on Sunday listened to Elk Busby reel off those names. He did a marvelous job.
He did a marvelous job, yes.
But it's so typical of pioneers. He had no sooner stopped and people were getting up to, you know, people going over talking to you and this one lady, whom I won't mention at the moment, said, he forgot all about my family. I came up here to work in a greenhouse. Wow.
This, I thought, was delightful. I was sitting next to Charlie Kramer, who bought the Busby cows and the dairy, you see, and he said to me, he's a better talker than he was a dairy man, says darling old Charlie.
Did you talk to Charlie very much today?
Yes.
Is he tracking pretty well these days?
Yes, he is. He sits there with those old bib overalls, and he's in a room with a very ill-tempered person, which he doesn't let get on his nerves at all. These two kind of stark beds in this little room kind of breaks your heart a little bit, you know.
The women at the Pioneer Home, well, you know, of course, you've seen Clara's room.
Oh, yes.
They bring in and make it all at home. But what you say about the men is really true.
But of course,
Charlie Kramer has only the one son.
Yes.
Donald. And he and his first wife are divorced. And I don't know his present wife. So it depends on the family a lot, too, how they're...
Yes, that's right. He's been there just about 10 days now. And I said, Charlie, do you like it? Oh, yes, everything's fine. And I said, his roommate was getting after Louis Black and told us to get that loud mouth out of his room. I said, Charlie, does it bother you? Oh, no. He doesn't bother me. He will be just fine, which I think is a marvelous attitude. He says, they're taking good care of me, and his feet were a little bit better, but he has a hard time getting to the lunchroom. Didn't you think so, Art?
Yeah, he sidles along the rail by the wall there and takes it pretty carefully.
But maybe when he gets, after he's been in the Pioneer Home a while and he has three square meals a day and he has the properly balanced meals and he has some medication for whatever may be wrong with him, he'll improve. Now, Dick Callahan, when he came in last fall, December, was in pretty bad shape.
He looks great.
And he now, at Golden Days time, he was downtown. He's in Nenana. He goes back and forth to Nenana. And I took him down to Nenana with me one day and for a funeral. And he wanted to stay. He didn't want to come home.
He's attractive.
He really is enjoying it. Maybe Charlie will...
Because Charlie's older and...
He must be 84.
Yes, he
is.
Because
Earl Beislein introduced him, I think he said he was born in 1889.
So now, I don't know how old Dick is, but when
Dick's
I...
Dick's 74.
Is that all?
He said he was born in 1899.
He was one of the older people that went to dances when I was getting out of high school. He was very good looking, and as I remember, a good dancer, but tragically, he was a half-breed in those days, you see, which is sad.
Yeah, I don't think he was a half-breed. I think he must be quarter.
Well, everybody that had anything was a half-breed when I was growing up. among the older people. Fortunately, I had no, ever had any feeling, but I'm sure it was hard.
He told me that he and Helen are both adopted in the Callahan family. Uh-huh. And
no, Helen is her mother's own child. She was telling me today that her mother was going home to Tanana, and she said, I think my mother said she just got tired carrying me, so she dropped me right at the foot of this hill, and they stayed there for a little while, and then they went on back to Tanana. She had a sister that became Rasmussen. I think there were three sisters, mm-hmm. and those were Grandma Callahan's own children. But this Dick was sort of somebody they just took in because he needed a home, and the old Mrs. Callahan just took in everybody.
Yeah.
And I asked her, I said, was old Dan good to your mother? And she said, yes, because he was an old teamster and I didn't know, a hard-talking old fellow, but I guess he was. Mm-hmm. Kind of a hard drinker, but I guess he was good to her.
Well, Dick told me that he doesn't have a birth certificate, but he has a baptismal record.
He showed it to us with pride.
And it took some doing to get it, because he wanted to get Siemens papers one time.
Mm-hmm.
But he's hard of hearing, and he hasn't learned how to turn his hearing aid up yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really interviewed him to get down to specifics.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these days I'll catch him and try to get chronologically what he's done. But, you know, he's just been everywhere.
Yes, he has, and he didn't show up for a little while, so that Helen was looking for him one time, and she thought he was dead because he'd gone off someplace, and finally they caught up with him in the hinterland someplace.
Yeah.
But get Helen's story. And Helen, at one time, was in the Episcopal missions or something, some way, with Archdeacon Stuck. And she has some pictures of herself. And I think she even taught school a little bit.
That's what Dick,
yes,
brother
she
told
did.
Me. She taught at Fort Yuma.
That's right.
And she could translate.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And she could speak both the Athabaskan and English. Uh-huh. And she uh-huh. taught school over uh-huh. there. I should do that. Uh-huh. There are a lot of them we should do. But
and she gave me a few pictures before the flood, which I must see that get to university, because they're her mother and this Mrs. Morency. You remember the Morency family, mm-hmm. Danny Morency and all these?
Yeah.
I have those pictures of her mother and Mrs. Morency fishing, and then the catch afterwards, I think 1900. And that's a long
time ago
for pictures.
That's an old picture.
Uh-huh. So those must go out here to the university.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad that you're conscious of this, the archives.
Yes,
of the university.
Yes. And Lois Morey was doing early pictures of schoolhouses, and I'm going to let her go through our pictures. And Kay Kennedy, I was able to give her, she's writing a book, she stopped by, so I gave her a picture that nobody had been able to find of that early aviator pressed, wasn't it?
Pressed,
uh-huh. And I happen to have one, you see.
Oh.
Well, it doesn't do me. I want these things to go where they will, where they'll do to somebody some
Those
good.
Those pictures can be copied.
Yes.
You know, they can be photographed.
Yes.
That's
but
what
I,
the university
yes.
lets people do.
Yes. Well, maybe Kay, if this is the only one extant, then she'll get it there. But
yeah.
She's writing this book on aviators, and I had some early pictures of Ben Eielson, because the girl that he went with was Bunnell's secretary for a while, Grace Clark, and I have wound up with her album that was sent to me by this Mildred Clark, who the girls were talking of, that was a teacher.
Yeah.
And she sent me Grace's album because she felt that it should be with somebody that knew these people, which is great.
Yeah.
So I gave Jean Bunnell a few pictures of herself from that album, and anything that will be pertinent at all, there'll be wives of early professors and all. If they want them, they can have them, you see. The archives here. Anything like that.
I know the two women who work in there, and there's one, she really, you know, she's always asking people if the subject comes up.
Uh-huh.
They go after whatever they can, and they have managed to get some marvelous collections.
Well, now we have pictures of an aunt who was in on Discovery, number one Discovery on Cleary. And this is Chattanooga, 1905. And there's a charming picture of a woman's foot race. You remember that one, Art?
Yeah.
And a charming picture of the interior of her cabin that she sent to my aunt, her mother, that has labeled everything. You know, all these things. She has a Max Comb moose hide. She has this little handmade things in order to, I suppose, assuage the worry of her mother, who was at the San Joaquin Valley, of this daughter that had come up in the early days to live so, you know, practically primitively.
Yeah.
So they're just charming, some of the mining pictures and all. And I've often thought they might be very nice for the Golden Days edition, but I was a little afraid to send them. Fair might not get them back,
no,
you see.
No, I wouldn't trust them to those miners. They didn't have a Golden Days edition as
no,
such
No, I noticed
year.
That. Uh-huh.
But normally they would, but if you would send them up in the care of somebody.
Yes.
Now, for example, I took pictures over Golden Days for the News Miner because they asked me to because they were short of people. And really, they don't have anybody on the staff now who cares about anything historical. So I did. But I made certain when I went back today, I had five rolls of film. And I had a lot of pioneers on And I took some at the reception for the King and Queen Regent and some of those old garments. You know, I took some available light pictures. I made certain I went over there today before they get filed away irretrievably, and I got them back. The same with the King and Queen Regent. I borrowed some of their old pictures, and I went back right the next day and got them before they got launched.
Now, if you are mixed up in any of these early day things, I would send you these pictures and let you use them and then send them back to me, because they're interesting old pictures and I don't suppose anybody else has them. It's just like Arnold Nardale has some very early pictures when they were in Cleary, when Cleary was quite but I don't think you're going to get them out of him. He's writing something anyway.
Yeah, I understand he has a marvelous collection of pictures.
But I'd be real happy to share these because I don't want to see them lost.
Yeah. The best resting place for them, I think, would be the archives at the university.
Yes, I'm sure
I'm sure that's what you're thinking
that's
of, too,
right.
Eventually.
Yeah. There's a lot of things I have that I still enjoy, but I want them to have things that are should never be with my own family because I'm enjoying them. I do lots of talking and share these things with lots with school children and all, but eventually they'll have to be here. I have the original... The original edition of the little Russian American reader that was designated to teach the Aleuts English, and it was from the Alaska Commercial Company in 1868 or so. Now they have reprinted it. Jerry Lardy has a reprint, but I have that original. Well, now the original edition, which of course my family it won't mean to them. They haven't been in Alaska for a long time. Belongs here. We have the 1868 portion of the Department of Agriculture built in all I could buy for 1868, right after the purchase of Alaska. Well, little things like this, maybe nobody else has saved, see?
Yeah.
And like the two issue of the Dalton Trail, maybe nobody else has these two magazines in sequence,
I'd love to see those. I'd make a trip to Coos Bay just to see those.
I'd love to have you come and show you.
I'm going to try to make that trip with on the Wickersham in September.
Yes.
On the return portion.
Uh-huh.
But the Pioneer Convention, the Alaska Pioneer Convention, conflicts with their dates.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote to them and I asked the man in charge if I, you know, told him I wanted to make the trip from Whitehorse South and wrote him a letter and told him the project I was on and so on and so forth. And he just wrote on the bottom of my letter, sorry, no more room, and then just sent the whole thing back.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll just get a hold of Governor Egan.
Yes.
And I'll stow away
if
I have to. That's just a challenge to me when I when someone says, well, I'm sorry, there's not room. Jimmy Doolittle will be on that trip.
And Jimmy, Stanton I knew as an obnoxious little brat, God love him, but he was out on campus, you see.
I've heard the same description of him from other people.
But he does a beautiful job of writing.
Yes, he does. And he's valuable for Alaska because he knows Alaska and he likes to write.
And he has his heart with it. Oh. We've been up too late at Jerry Lardy's last night and too late at Rusty Hurley's the night before. Far too late, you see. But this is the interesting thing. This is why we come.
I just had the tape recorder going here while we're just talking, just to, you know, we're picking up odds and ends of things. But what I'd like to do is get some, kind of talk about university when you, well, first of all, I want to get when you were born. So if you don't mind, could I just start asking you a few questions to kind of lead you in those things? And if you think of anything, you speak up too, would you, Art?
Yeah,
because
sure.
this is just so we can have, for the Town of Yukon Historical Society, and it's not going to be published or put on the radio or anything.
But now you want to be sure and get his story of transferring of coal from the broad gauge to the narrow gauge, which allowed him to make enough money to go to college. And that is a fabulous story, which Jack McPhee has written up on one of those historical Western things. You know, do you ever see those magazines?
No.
Do you know of Jack McPhee?
I've heard
him. Writes quite well. And he wrote art up in that magazine on this fabulous transferring coal. So you must get his story on that because it's interesting.
Jack worked in the freight office, and the whole freight office gang would have to go down and transfer coal, 4-foot wood, nested hydraulic pipe for the FE company, big valves up to 500 pounds, and all the freight that had to go out the creeks, they were doing it, the freight office gang that worked at
the FE company?
No.
Or for the railroad?
On the railroad, out in the yards past the roundhouse.
Mm-hmm. The broad gauge came into Fairbanks, the narrow gauge went out to the creeks.
And
it had to be transferred
to the narrow gauge tracks. Well, I took it over, 40 cents a ton and 40 cents a cord for wood, and handled it all alone. And had a good time at it, too. My best day was two big gondolas heaped up with mine run. That was, should have been 80 ton at least, but Jack McPhee said it was 70 ton or something like that. But maybe there were long tons for that low-grade coal.
You did that in one day?
In 14 hours.
Holy smokes.
That was a good day. And there'd be chunks up to 150 pounds. I couldn't shovel those. I had to pick them up. And there was about a 4-foot chute between the cars, and I'd just push it over the chute.
And when was this? What years?
When was about 22, maybe?
22, 23. Jack McPhee said you set an all-time world record. There was nobody came near it.
They tipped over one of the narrow gauge cars once, you know, if you put too much weight on the opposite side, the car would tip over. Well, I'd stick a couple of props under it, and then I'd never load the one side too full before I'd start the other side on the ends.
Oh, I see.
Balance it a little bit. So I was very lucky, and I don't know now how I transferred those big nests of pipe from 30 inches down, they'd be all nested together and quite heavy and mean to handle. I had to cut the car stakes and rig up skids, roll them over and catch them. I couldn't let them bang around too much. If they hit the other side of the narrow gauge car, they'd cut over.
Yeah, tip it over.
But
did you do it by yourself?
I did it alone, all of it. Right now, I don't know how I did it. But I just was careful. I worked alone all my life, and there's always ways to rig things up, so you make out.
Well, pipe that's... You mean a smaller pipe was inside larger pipes, so by the time you had one pipe that you were transferring, you had a lot of weight.
Yes, it would be about 4 pipes in a nest.
Mm-hmm. What did they call that railroad, the narrow gauge? Was that one that went Tanana Valley Railroad.
And it was owned and run by Falcon Jocelyn.
Falcon Jocelyn?
Jocelyn, J-O... E-L-O-N, I think. Now, he had a brother, John Jocelyn, that had the Columbia Hotel when Old Man King had the barn behind it. That's a long time ago.
I'm thinking J-O-C-E-L-Y-N, but I'm not sure.
No, I don't know.
J-O-C-E-L-Y-N.
I don't know, but it will be in any local history, because that's Falk and Jocelyn. It started at Chena, because that was the best place for the boats to unload, wasn't it, in those days, because they didn't have to come up across Leah Bar and all these bars, so that they had the railroad, and the town of Chena was quite a good town. In a way, Fairbanks should have been at the Chena site, should it not?
Yeah, there was a quartz mill there, too.
That's what a lot of people have said, especially after the 1967 flood, because it would have expanded up on the ridge, and would have been a very likely, very logical spot to put the...
Except for the water problem there, to get water, and other problems building on that hillside.
Right.
But that little railroad was the only way, when I was a youngster, to get to the creeks, because there weren't any roads. The earlier roads, I think, were in the late teens and early 20s, when Tom Gibson and all went out there. But there was the railroad that went to Olness and went to Chattanooga, and that was the only way the miners had of getting anything in there or having communication with Fairbanks, you see. So it was a lifeline.
I was a brakeman on it several trips, and I don't remember if we went to Chattanooga or not. I know we went to Olness. We may have gone to Chattanooga, but Chattanooga sort of died out. There were small saloons there with the wallpaper hanging down from the ceiling, and dark in there, and it is a very depressing sight.
But this transferring of freight, with all your effort, is what allowed you to go to school. Well, that was the only money that you were making, and hard money.
Yeah, and then in 26, I went back to Wisconsin and sold 40 acres to my oldest brother I'd been making payments on, and bought a Chevrolet touring car and brought that back to Fairbanks. And Judge Bunnell says you might as well run a college taxi as long as you're going to town a lot. And so it was, I think, two bits a round trip, so I got a little gasoline money.
So this is why you were going to college?
Yes, and then another kid bought some hand-operated barber tools, and Judge Bunnell rustled a old barber chair and put it in the basement there in one little room, and Adams, was that his name? He felt inadequate as a barber, so he says, I'll sell you my tools for 25. He said he had that much in it, and I think I paid way too much for them. But anyhow, I bought them for 25 and took over, and I was cutting the boys and the teachers and the girls, boyish bobs, shingles, windblowns.
With no barber college knowledge whatsoever.
Several other, I gave them anything they wanted.
Yeah.
And I'd had no training or experience at all, but it all looked like an open book to me. The only book that did look open to me was barber book.
Yeah. Well, to get back to you, Dorothy, you came up here in 1906.
Yes. I was a year old, and mother then had her last child in January of 1907. So she came up expecting this child, left the San Joaquin Valley in California. She was 41. She came to her a wide, wild town here, and it frightened her to death. She had an older daughter that picked up TB here, because in those days the attendance record was added into the academic record. You know, it all was added up together. And this sister of mine, whom I don't remember at all, Irma, had practically all 98s and 99s. Well, she had this very bad cold, so she didn't get a good attendance record, and that was bringing her general average down. She insisted on going to school. Well, she picked up TB, and mother took her outside, and she died in 1909. Then my mother had to come back, because my father already then was tied up tighter than tight in all this mining business, and she hated every day she lived here, which is the saddest thing.
But your sister died in
1909.
So did you go outside with your mother?
Yes. I remember it very slightly. I do remember we came back in, and both my sister and I picked up typhoid fever in Dawson, and mother nearly lost both of us again.
Perhaps,
so it was a very sad thing for her.
Yes.
But my father, I have one letter I would love to show you. He had written to his law partner in Visalia, California. This mine that he was going to have and the contingency fees, why he was going to just have it made. He was going to make so much, he was going to bring his whole family out, and the world would be his. Now that was in, that letter was written in 1907, and I we have that at home. And it is the saga of every early day man. Mm-hmm. This eternal, infernal hope. Hell for a lot of the women.
Yeah.
Not for this aunt, whom I met outside, the one that I have the pictures of. I said to her, why was it that you remember all this with so much pleasure, and you had such a good time, and my mother hated it? Then all of a sudden, I thought, they made a fortune there. In Chattanooga, they were able to go outside and live the rest of their lives in California,
yes,
with the minimum of anything else, you see.
Yeah.
So their success and failure, you see.
And her dad was district attorney, getting a nice salary and pouring it into the so-called mining.
But his aim was to own a producing
mine. He did. It was outright almost where we have the Pedro Monument, just a little bit further. It was at Scoogee Gulch, and it was a narrow, after we were taking geology, I took a minor in geology, and we saw this narrow, consistent little vein, never a rich pocket, never anything, and they put 3 mills on that.
At least.
All this money.
Stamp mill, a rod mill, a ball
and
mill.
And a roller mill. Mm-hmm.
So all of his legal fees went into the ground.
That's right. He underwrote the whole thing. And do you know of a David Maddox here?
No, I don't know.
Now, there's somebody you must interview because he has a memory that's wonderful. And his father was my father's partner. He did the actual mining, and my father fed the money.
You were born then in
California.
California. Mm-hmm. In 1905?
1905. January 1st, 1905.
You know who else was born January 1st? It's Forbes Baker.
Really? Mm-hmm. Forbes was a neighbor of ours on 2nd Avenue.
Mm-hmm. He's in England right now.
That's what Evelyn told us.
Just a holiday. But, he planned to be back for Golden Days, which is a big highlight in his life. But he must be having a good time. Mm-hmm. He might as well stay over there.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And he went on just kind of a whim.
Mm-hmm.
It was a last-minute idea, and he just took off and went.
Is he quite spry yet on his feet?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
He's had 2 pretty serious heart attacks, and Evelyn was a little bit concerned last fall before he left. She thought he might not come back from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Came back looking tan and healthy and spry, and well, he's not as spry as he'd like to be, but he's in amazingly good health.
Mm-hmm.
He did have one very, very serious heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
But he lives, he said, when I talked to him, he said he just lives every day and he tries to live as well as he can each day.
Good.
And he's enjoying life.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And he's in the position where he can, apparently.
Good.
And it just happened that a man at the university and his wife, who teaches in the school system, were going to London. And so, off he went.
I'm all for that.
Anyway, back to you. You came here at 1 year, and your sister's name is
Florence.
Florence.
Mm-hmm. And she was born then in 1907. So she was a native daughter of the Golden North. And when they had all the 21st of June at that time was a very important celebration. And she always got to ride on the floats with the native daughters here of Alaska. And I never could because I was a native daughter of the Golden West. And she got to present the flowers to Mrs. Wickersham one time, the delegate's wife. And I didn't even get to go because I wasn't a native daughter. Mm. And, oh, that was gall and wormwood.
You weren't even a decent sidewalk.
No.
I got a kick out of Amanda Hansen today when she was talking about the pioneer women of Alaska. And they're the real pioneer women of Alaska. As opposed to the auxiliary, and how she put it, Pioneer Women of Alaska came to this country before 1908 with their clothes on.
Yes, the others were
then
born.
She pointed to someone mm-hmm. across the table and she said, they came here and stark naked.
That's
they
right.
arrived stark uh-huh. naked. So that's one way to... I hope that's not our friend buzzing our house again. If it is, I'm afraid I'm going to have to turn him into the FAA this time. Rather than pick him up and... pieces from an airplane mm-hmm. one of these days.
Mm-hmm. Is he romancing someone?
No, he's a friend of my son's, and you know how boys are. They mm-hmm. they like to
show off
and do their thing. He's a good pilot, but he's mm-hmm. I just hate to see boys take mm-hmm. risks that they don't have.
You might like to know this. 1912 or 13. There was the first little airplane that came up on the upper deck of a little stern wheeler, and I can still remember that. And I was real small. It came up on this upper deck of this little river steamer, and they took it out to the ballpark, which was afterwards Weeks Field, the ballpark, and they sold tickets for $5 for the people to go out and see that little tiny biplane go up.
Just to look at it?
To look at it go up, you see, because it didn't go up very far. And my father and my mother each paid $5 to see that. And Mrs. Athol, whose husband was afterwards judge in Kelso and was judge here, she took us, two little girls, and we crawled out on the porch, and she had opera glasses, so we could see a little something. But they all went out there to see this little plane. But
you
to think of paying
$5 in 1912 is a lot of money.
Yes.
Well, if they sold a half dozen tickets, that was a good money for
I'm
them.
Sure they sold a lot, but think what it must have cost to have put that little plane on the upper deck of that river steamer. It had to come up by ocean, then it had to come up from St. Michael's on this little stern wheeler, clear into Fairbanks.
Hay and oats were $40 a ton from Seattle to Fairbanks in those days, they told me.
But I'm so glad
that long river.
Now, Mrs. Rust would remember that. There aren't very many of us that would remember that little airplane coming up here and people paying to see it.
And
excuse me, go ahead.
Bill Green said he paid $5.